listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. In Marilyn Robinson's luminous fiction, she peels back the surface of ordinary lives. Where does God's grace live? Her characters suggest we look in our own flawed selves, in our difficult lives, in our willingness or not to make peace with the irreconcilable. In When I Was a Child, I Read Books, her most recent collection of essays, Robinson wrote, "I looked to Galilee for meaning and to Spokane for orthodonture, and beyond that, the world where I was, I found entirely sufficient." Her profound new novel, Lila, is no less than a meditation for an apprehension of the world that Marilyn Robinson finds herself in, that her characters find themselves in, that we all find ourselves in, with its imperfections, conflicts, the mud on the kitchen floor, the sunlight striking the dishes in the sink. The lives that take center stage in the last three of Robinson's four novels, Gilead, Home, and now Lila, are linked, as you'll see tonight, not sequentially but concurrently. And we encounter similar conversations, similar stories encountered from different perspectives. In Lila, the title character, a longtime drifter who was abandoned as a child, has resorted at times to prostitution, moves to Gilead, Iowa, a dusty little town once a stop on the Underground Railroad. There she pauses from her life on the run to step into the local church to get out of the rain and meets the widowed Reverend John Ames, the grandson of the town's fiery Congregationalist minister and the son of another minister, a pacifist. Ames's first wife has died in childbirth with their baby, and he's been alone for 40 years until, at the age of 67, he meets Lila in her shabby dress and falls in love with her. Lila's new life with new questions commences. It's all a prayer, Ames reminds us. Family is a prayer, wife is a prayer, marriage is a prayer. Marilyn Robinson is known for both her fiction and nonfiction. Her first novel, Housekeeping, which I'm sure most of you can remember reading. I read it so ravenously, won the Hemingway Pen Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer. Her novel, Gilead, won the 2005 Pulitzer Prize, and Home was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And Lila, from which Marilyn Robinson will read and discuss tonight, is a finalist for this year's National Book Award, and we will find out the results soon. We're rooting. Her book, four books of nonfiction include When I Was a Child, I Read Book, Mother Country, The Death of Adam, and Absence of Mine. She teaches at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she has served as deacon for the in Iowa City, where she has served as deacon for the Congregational United Church of Christ. And Michael Silverblatt, who will be interviewing Marilyn tonight, I'm sure you all know from his long-running show, Bookworm, which he created for KCRW in 1989. Michael is one of America's great readers and a discerning literary critic. And tonight he rejoins Marilyn Robinson, picking up their lively conversation where they left off a few years ago on this same stage. Those of you may remember that as well. So with no further ado, please welcome Marilyn Robinson and Michael Silverblatt.
Thank you. Thank you for a very kind introduction. It's a wonderful pleasure to be here. I wish I could stay longer in California. Oh, it's really impressive. I'm going to read a few pages from the beginning of Lila to begin the conversation. The child was just there on the stoop in the dark, hugging herself against the cold, all cried out and nearly sleeping. She couldn't holler anymore, and they didn't hear her anyway, or they might, and that would make things worse. Somebody had shouted, "Shut that thing up or I'll do it," and then a woman grabbed her out from under the table by her arm and pushed her out onto the stoop and shut the door, and the cats went under the house. They wouldn't let her near them anymore because she picked them up by their tails sometimes. Her arms were all over scratches, and the scratches stung. She had crawled under the house to find the cats, but even when she did catch one in her hands, it struggled harder the harder she held on to it, and it bit her, so she let it go. "Why you keep pounding at the screen door? Nobody gonna want you around if you act like that." And then the door closed again, and after a while, night came. The people inside fought themselves quiet, and it was night for a long time. She was afraid to be under the house and afraid to be up on the stoop, but if she stayed by the door, it might open. There was a moon staring straight at her, and there were sounds in the woods, but she was nearly sleeping when Doll came up the path and found her there like that, miserable as could be, and took her up in her arms and wrapped her into her shawl and said, "Well, we got no place to go. Where are we going to go?" If there was anyone in the world the child hated worst, it was Doll. She'd go scrubbing at her face with a wet rag, or she'd be after her hair with a busted comb trying to get the snarls out. Doll slept at the house most nights, and maybe she paid for it by sweeping up a little. She was the only one who did any sweeping, and she'd be cussing while she did it. "Don't do one damn bit of good." And someone would say, "Then leave it be, damn it." There'd be people sleeping right on the floor in some old mess of quilts and gunny sacks you wouldn't know from one day to the next. When the child stayed under the table, they would forget her most of the time. The table was shoved into a corner, and they wouldn't go to the trouble of reaching under to pull her out of there if she kept quiet enough. When Doll came in at night, she would kneel down and spread that shawl over her. But then she left again so early in the morning that the child would feel the shawl slip off, and she'd feel colder for the lost warmth of it, and stir and cuss a little. But there would be hardtack, an apple, something, and a cup of water left there for her when she woke up. Once there was a kind of toy. It was just a horse chestnut with a bit of cloth over it tied with a string, and two knots at the sides and two at the bottom like hands and feet. The child whispered to it and slept with it under her shirt. Lila would never tell anyone about that time. She knew it would sound very sad, and it wasn't really. Doll had taken her up in her arms and wrapped her shawl around her. "You just hush now," she said. "Don't go waking folks up." She settled the child on her hip and carried her into the dark house, stepping as carefully and quietly as she could, and found the bundle she kept in her corner, and then they went out into the chilly dark again down the steps. The house was rank with sleep, and the night was windy, full of tree sounds. The moon was gone, and there was rain, so fine then it was only a tingle on the skin. The child was 4 or 5, long-legged, and Doll couldn't keep her covered up, but she chafed at her calves with her big, rough hand and brushed the damp from her cheek and her hair. She whispered, "Don't know what I think I'm doing. Never figured on it. Well, maybe I did. I don't know. I guess I probably did. This sure ain't the night for it." She hitched up her apron to cover the child's legs and carried her out past the clearing. The door might have opened, and a woman might have called after them, "Where are you going with that child?" And then, after a minute, closed the door again, as if she had done all decency required. "Well," Doll whispered, "we'll just have to see." The road wasn't really much more than a path, but Doll had walked it so often in the dark that she stepped over the roots and around the potholes and never paused or stumbled. She could walk quickly when there was no light at all. And she was strong enough that even an awkward burden like a leggy child could rest in her arms almost asleep. Lila knew it couldn't have been the way she remembered it, as if she were carried along in the wind, and there were arms around her to let her know she was safe, and there was a whisper at her ear to let her know that she shouldn't be lonely. The whisper said, "I got to find a place to put you down. I got to find a dry place." And then they sat on the ground on pine needles, Doll with her back against a tree and the child curled into her lap against her breast, hearing the beat of her heart, feeling it. Rain fell heavily. Big drops spattered them sometimes. Doll said, I should have known it was coming on rain, and now you got the fever. But the child just lay against her, hoping to stay where she was, hoping the rain wouldn't end. Doll may have been the loneliest woman in the world, and she was the loneliest child, and there they were, the two of them together, keeping each other warm in the rain. Thank you. Hello.
It's a pleasure to see you again.
Well, it's wonderful to see you.
Marilyn and I have spoken about all three of these books and several others. And so it is a continuing conversation. And one of the things I noticed this time is that the people writing about Lila are writing so well about it this time round. They didn't write so well about Gilead or about home, but they really are writing well about Lila. And it makes me think it must have been a very difficult book to write if the critics are writing so well about it.
Well, I think I had to give them more information than they had in the first two books. I gave them, I think, a world that they knew better by the time the third book came out.
But I think they are in love with a lonely, long-legged, squawky, balky young woman who suffered loneliness, who enters a world and finds love there. That there's something irresistible about what you've done this time that even a critic can't resist.
Well, thank you, but I have to say that I think I've been very well treated by critics over time. I really feel as if, I mean, when I, you know, set out writing a book about a minister dying in Iowa in 1956, I didn't expect a whole lot of attention, you know. I mean, it's an improbable subject on its face, I think. And I think that the critics may have strained a little with the exotic character of it, but that they were very fair, that being true.
I think that is true, but what they didn't know how to do, I think, was to read a book with not just a spiritual, but a religious center, and that they weren't sure how to take the religious debates in the book because they had stopped having them such a long time ago.
I think that's probably true. And I think the way that religious history is remembered, it's as if wherever there's a difference of opinion, there's an incipient warfare, you know. Whereas in fact, you know, over time, one of the great pleasures of theology has been that people argue about it. It's thoroughly debated, as any complex subject tends to be.
And I think Lila wins the heart because she says immediately, practically, that she doesn't like theology to Reverend John Ames, who will be her husband soon. She says she might come to, but that's because she's bearing his child.
She doesn't want to be unkind, you know, she's just candid.
But I wondered what it is that you knew or thought that you could restore to the novel by bringing back the spirit of theological disputation and yearning.
Well, things sort of go in another order for me. I'm very interested in theology. If I were, you know, stranded, as they say, on a desert island with a set of books, it would be theology. I don't know if I could write something that's truly non-theological at this point because I've saturated myself. I love the scale of it. I like to read science. I like to read the hypotheses about the cosmos and so on, or subatomic reality, all these lovely things. And they're they in scale are comparable to theology if you make no other association between them. There's a largeness that allows room enough for any kind, you know, big thinking, frankly, which never excludes human presence. I mean, because, thinking is quintessentially human. And I don't know, I love it very much. It creates for me the scale at which reality is most interestingly seen. So that's what I write about.
But you see, I think, I'm not going to say single-handedly, that would be silly, but there would have been those who said that it would be impossible for a serious literary novel to take up truly religious themes, especially questions about God's role in the universe. We have some. I think Alice McDermott, for instance, does, mostly Catholic. Mm. But by and large, I think that you flipped the switch when it came to this and brought many people to an awareness that not to think about God, about joy, about existence, about suffering, about loneliness, and their interrelation would be, not to think of these things, would be to live in the world without thinking of the basic issues that living in the world requires.
That seems so to me. You know, you're preaching to the choir. these strange things go through the culture. I encounter them all the time because I teach young writers, you know. So you hear, you can't make a good character who is interesting. You know, well, look at literature. I mean, before the middle 20th century, at least, literature is full of good people, you know, who I think are quite interesting, Ishmael and Queequeg, and, you know. And another thing that you hear, and it's these things are just like graven in stone. You can't write about God as being something to be considered, you know, in the large sphere of what is to be considered, thought about, you know. Who says? You know, I mean, it really bothers me. I mean, some things that are said of that kind might be true for the people who said them, and that's great. But there's a kind of a legislation in these utterances, you know, that people actually take very seriously, and they suppress or curb or curtail what they might do out of the authenticity of their own experience. I don't understand that. I mean, the chill that it puts on the thinking of the best minds we have is really extraordinary.
Now, I guess I have to take responsibility here. I wrote an article which in America was given credit for inventing the words transgressive fiction. Mm. So in the American Heritage Dictionary of New Expressions and Phrases, I'm given credit for this. Of course, the credit is not due to me. It was used in Europe many times over, but I was writing about Kathy Acker and Dennis Cooper and Children of Sod. And I didn't see any way to talk about it without talking about a spirit of transgression. And I think that that became that literature so popular that children who'd grown up in gated communities were nevertheless writing about their experiences as prostitutes or slaves.
Exactly.
And it became a very attractive subject. And I think, I wonder what it is, because I do think we are in a new sphere, partly because of your writing, that being good is worth the candle.
Well, you know, I do think anybody that's really made an effort at it knows that it's much harder than it seems to look to, you know, to people who, I don't know, devalue it so, you know. I don't understand. I mean, what is being transgressed in transgressive behavior can be transgression?
It's a transgression, as I came to understand it when doing this research, against the human body. Oh. The belief that it was made to understand itself by suffering torture and experiences that took it out of the realm of everyday emotion into the hypostatic impossible, and that this was modeled on concentration camps, and that this would forever after be the code with which the body would be viewed.
Well, then Hitler won the war, I guess.
One more time?
I said, then Hitler won the war.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah, that's sad.
I think it's terrifying, but I think that so many American children grew up. I was a Jewish child in America, and I grew up in a house with very few books. Among the very few books were books about the rise and fall of the Third Reich, and I'd look at them, and these were the only places I would find where parts of the body were named. They were parts of the body inflicted with extreme pain, but they were nevertheless the place where, I think, a very bad spirit was with. The place where, I think, a very bad spirit was with. I, you know, had a neighbor who had a number on his arm. I asked him what camp he had been in because I had read them. What camp he had been in because I had read these books on my parents' shelf, and he said, oh, you know the difference, which one from another. No one wanted to talk about it, so it was the big secret that cannibalism and all sorts of Satanism had returned to the world and that we were growing up in its shadow.
Well, you know, I mean, it's difficult to say that cannibalism is not purely a novelty in human history. You know, I mean, cities used to prepare for sieges, pagan, you know, cities, by deciding how many women were necessary to basically cook, to do the cooking, that is. And then they would, no, literally, they would butcher the rest of them for food. So you could eat the women, and the women would not eat whatever else there was to eat, you know? I mean, the history of the world is absolutely terrifying if you want to go from atrocity to atrocity, which is not hard to do. But the things that you begin to value then are the places where atrocity recedes, you know? I mean, the fact that we sometimes act humanely, and even as societies are relatively humane and relatively humane over meaningful periods of time, that's miraculous. And the idea that it's treated as unreal and as if we should invite these demons that are always ready to come, you know, is just astonishing to me. I think our greatest vulnerability as civilizations is our contempt for the best things we've achieved.
And I think, you see, I don't want to sound too silly about this, because I have enormous respect for the way in which the bad mood, it's not even correct to call it the bad mood, the terrors of the 20th century settled among us. And yet I remember feeling when I opened Housekeeping, it was a book I'd bought within 2 weeks, that here was a perception of the beauty of the natural world that somehow was a viable competitor to the race being run to win the cup for the ugliness of the world. You know, the books that people were reading then, you know, Catch-22, Pinchon, things called black humor and then eventually metafiction, all of them seemingly contradicted very easily by the beauty of a dragonfly, by the extraordinary nimbus of rainbow colors on a soap bubble, and by, dare I say it, the extraordinary pleasure I took in reading those words instead of the traumatized language of the post-war. And it really interested me. I couldn't account for Marilyn Robinson in the slightest, because most of the time, book blurbs come from the teachers of the writer, and they're all at the same school. But these blurbs came from John Hawkes, Doris Lessing, and Walker Percy, three writers who I feel sure never met, and were so different in their aesthetic that I picked up the book, I opened to the first paragraph. Oh my God, what a first paragraph. So beautiful. And you know, I don't know, I love embroidered syntax and the way in which, can I read a little bit of it? Do you mind?
Go right ahead, feel free.
My name is Ruth. I grew up with my younger sister, Lucille, under the care of my grandmother, Mrs. Sylvia Foster, and when she died, of her sisters-in-law, Mrs. Lily and Nona Foster, and when they fled, and when they fled, of her daughter, Mrs. Sylvia Fisher. Through all these generations of elders, we lived in one house, my grandmother's house, built for her by her husband, Edmund Foster, an employee of the railroad who'd escaped this world years before I entered it. It was he who put us down in this unlikely place. He had grown up in the Middle West in a house dug out of the ground. In a house dug out of the ground. With windows just at earth level and just at eye level, so that from without, the house was a mere mound, no more a human stronghold than a grave, and from within, the perfect horizontality of the world in that place foreshortened the view so severely that the horizon seemed to circumscribe the sod house and nothing more. A world in which your house is at the middle of the world, at the middle of the horizon, and everything that will emerge from there is central to the self and the family and the place that you are. And I spent so long reading this book, and there's a vision of going out on a lake and seeing salt crystals form that I swear is as good and maybe better as anything in Emerson and Thoreau. I couldn't believe how much the beauty of the language of this book was rescuing me from my choice to be thrilled by the horrors that were being made up for me sometimes by John Hawkes. He wrote a book called The Cannibal that climaxes with the eating of a child, the blood in a thermos bottle. So I looked to Marilynne Robinson, who did not write another book for some 20 years, to be the rescue of the soul, the rescuer of the soul. I just sensed that. And then when Gilead came out, and I said, oh, I was right. Well, I like to be right. What took 20 years?
Oh, I was reading and thinking about things and writing the essays in The Death of Adam and writing Mother Country.
And when you wrote it, you must know how important these books have become, not just to Christians, but to people yearning for a theological center, a sense of restoration that can begin with the question that would go something like, if God doesn't exist, what does? I mean, it's a thrilling question.
It is indeed. It is indeed. I encourage my students to subscribe to Scientific American. The way that science opens and unfolds complexity and unfolds complexities more that are deeper yet, and then unfolds anomalies, and then, you know, so that, I mean, whether you're thinking of it microcosmically or macrocosmically, everything is always a huge expansion. And whether hypothetical or demonstrated, you know, in the terms that are appropriate, it's always a liberation of thinking. How amazing. Dark energy, things like this that are like two-word poems, you know. I think that if people read more contemporary science, the real thing, not you know, these little determinist things that people have been fiddling around with forever, that they would find, you know, the affinity, the opening up into theological thinking, whether it's Judaism or Hinduism or, you know, any appropriately large scale form of thought, where the fact that things, that there is so much more beyond the simply tactile, the simply available, which is what human beings have always known. You know, we've really been asked to suppress our deepest intuitions as human beings, subservient to an idea of science that is actually 18th century science, that cannot deal at all with what truly contemporary science has discovered and posited. I read, you know, you get a new cosmology about every 3 months. But everyone beautiful. I'm not, you know, that's fine. You know, of course, we're talking about something that we can't capture, you know. But everything is maybe some step in the direction of comprehension. It's beautiful. And we live in a time when to watch this kind of thinking should be a great privilege. I'm more a missionary, or as much a missionary for contemporary scientific thought as I am for theology, because we have been trapped into small, inhumane models of thinking that are completely inappropriate to us.
Because people almost immediately want to trap the Christian into the pitfalls of conservative thought. I want to quote Marilynne Robinson on some things that made me very happy to read in her interviews recently, so we can get on to a more important question. Because, you know, churches have consternation, an old-fashioned word, about same-sex marriage, Marilynne Robinson says, oh, well, you know, there was no time more given to same-sex relations than Hellenistic Greece, and Jesus was there at the time. We don't find Jesus yelling about same-sex relationships. Surely, if they were so wrong, such a scandal, Jesus would have spoken against them. And then she said, my church is among the first to welcome same-sex marriages. We bless them, we ordain them, and we have been doing so for some time. Then, of course, the next question, I think it's called religious news today. The next question they ask is about abortion. And Marilynne Robinson says, I think we should spend time worrying about the babies that are here that need our help and not about the babies that don't exist yet. And I think, thank you, Marilynne, for in one stroke saying implicitly that other kind of thought is not very Christian, yes?
I don't, you know, I think that I've seen Christianity change a great deal in, you know, in the last 30 years. As an articulated cultural presence, it has become opposed in many instances to what could only be called compassion. And I think that's, you know, that is extraordinary. What an incredible inversion of values that is, you know. And it pains me very much because a lot of the best people I know are repelled, are driven away from Christianity, if assuming that would otherwise be their religion, by the fact that they are kinder hearted than what they see represented as Christianity. I mean, instead of learning compassion from Jesus, which is the classic assumption that we should do, we're supposed to develop these bright lines of bad people on one side, good people on, you know, or saved and damned or whatever, you know. What? There are, you know, the Richard Dawkinses and so on that I have little pillow fights with everyone that probably never notice that they're, you know, I'm pillow fighting with them, but they're not the ones that really make the case against religion. The people that make the case against religion are the ones that make it into something that forbids compassion, imagination, generosity in many cases, you know. I think this is a terrible pity. People that feel that Christianity is on the march, I think something else is on the march, and it's not helping Christianity a bit.
Now let's talk about Lila, because no matter what a writer may believe, the proof is in the work. And I wanted to ask you what the role of natural beauty is in your work, because you're so very good at describing it.
Thank you. Well, you know, I've gotten through this whole evening without mentioning Calvin once. That just ended. But you know, he has this wonderful metaphor. He says creation is the shimmering garment in which God is revealed and concealed. You know? And that seems very beautiful to me. I mean, that there's a luminousness and an opacity in what we can perceive simultaneously. And in a way, the opacity suggesting something behind the opacity, you know? And that sort of consciousness, I think, is very present in my writing because it guides my vision, that thought. You know, I mean, when I look at something, it's an interesting question to me precisely because it is transparent and opaque, you know? It's very beautiful.
And the characters, Lila and Dahl, see it even when those who loved housekeeping will love Lila again because it begins with a group of characters who are drifters. It's the Dust Bowl years, it's the Depression, and this is the America that we like to think about, where people came to the door and asked, can you pay me for a day's work? And they would be given work to do. We like to think of there being apple pies on the windowsill that are stolen by hobos, but which have been actually put there for the hobos to swipe. I want to live in this world, and this book takes me to it. And I wanted to ask about the ability to perceive beauty in the midst of suffering.
I think, you know, when you look at, you know, the history of art, poetry, how many poets spent brief lives in ill health without necessarily enough to eat, knowing that their children would probably not live as long as they lived, you know? I mean, the life of many brilliant people has been excruciating. And this does not at all diminish their freedom to see beauty beyond their own circumstance. It doesn't make it escapist. In many cases, you know, you think of Keats, you know, seeing with that kind of precision that seems heightened by the sadness and the difficulty of his life. So many of them. We have this funny tendency, which really is not sustainable historically, to think that people become aesthetically productive after they've gone through a sort of regimen of privilege, you know? But there's nothing in history to demonstrate that. To use a word that usually makes me shudder, but there is a kind of elitism in the idea that people who are hard-pressed in one way or another are not brilliant, you know? I mean, God knows. I remember reading the thing about starfish and about how they thought they had no eyes, and then they realized that they're entirely covered with eyes, you know? But, you know, if you think of the world, about the fact that the very vast majority of people never have any opportunity to make a meaningful or remembered articulation of what they perceive, and yet they're bringing the brilliance of human consciousness to bear day after day. You know, the first thing we know practically about human civilizations is that they couldn't stop watching the stars, you know? And they made mathematics based on their fascination with these extraordinary things, and they shaped rocks. They made aesthetics out of the most resistant substances you could imagine. You know, I think that we need to think of the world the way you would think of a starfish. It's all perception. It's all perception. It's simply a fact that we don't normally know where it occurs, how it occurs. We can just assume it.
I think it's not just poems that told us this. It was songs.
Absolutely.
That told us this. And I'm sorry, But I just break up when I hear that the stars belong to everyone and love can come to anyone. The best things in life are free. And in Lila, there's a line, I couldn't help it. It's just one line. You're all dressed up to go dreaming. And my mind immediately said, and don't you tell me I'm wrong. And it's moonlight becomes you. It goes with your hair. You really do know the best things to wear. And, you know, for me, the vision of loveliness is one that I can't live without. I would like to be aggressive and say is one that we can't live without. But I can't live without it, at least, and I think that you can't either. And you see, I'm always grateful to find an old song referred to in a book, because the place where it's referred to is in a brothel. And someone sings, you're all dressed up to go dreaming snidely because the pretty dress-up clothes have been taken away by the madam and now they're wearing flannel sleepers and gunny sacks, and one of them sings, you're all dressed up to go dreaming. And yes, I guess it is always the case that good and bad, sweetness and sour, sweetness and sadness are cheek by jowl, and they have to be.
Yes. Yes. I sometimes think, you know, we all know these old poems like the small rain down doth rain, you know, these. I think that there are songs that we don't even think about, very, very vernacular sort of ballads that will be a cherished poetry when they are seen by, you know, in a few generations. So often, so tenderly emotional in one way or another. So beautifully spare and colloquial in their language and so on. I tried, when I was writing Lila, I had very much in mind, perhaps, that I was writing a ballad. And the idea of a ballad is a sort of discipline of the language, you know.
Well, it's a extraordinary passage. Lila begins the way many spunky heroines would, but she's so much more than spunky. She is herself compassionate. She likes to lie down next to the old man, John Ames. She likes his warmth. She likes his silveriness. She likes to put her ear on his chest. And I think, well, isn't that wonderful? You know, even though she has to take it back right away and say, well, you're not the only old man I ever... Yeah, you know, she's spiky. And she feels if she gets caught in too much sentiment that she'll be shamed. Shame is a dominant feeling in her. What made us be so ashamed of sentiment?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I just observe. But it is true, I think, that in one way or another, and ways that are exploited in all sorts of ways, you know, without necessarily using the word, I think that shame is a very powerful motivating impulse, even in places where it seems to be contrary to every objective reality about a person's circumstance. And I think that the narrative of the Garden of Eden is really about this thing descending on us, you know, shame, there it is, you know. And it's a sort of amazingly strong human burden that even drives, you know, you read about people like, say, Stalin, you know, who have these horrible childhoods, and then spend the rest of their lives trying to compensate as if they are, you know, like, and I think that the hunger that they're responding to would be aptly called shame.
Well, the microphone is going to be going around to the audience in any minute, and, you know, all you need to do is raise your hand. But first, I want you to put your hands. And just raising your hand will do it. There. Okay.
Thank you. I wondered if the theologians and the theologies you've discussed this evening were not contemporary. And I wonder if there's anyone American or internationally writing theology today that's not deterministic, as you compared the Scientific American and other scientific writings. And I also wondered if you would mention just other writing influences and reading influences. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm not reading, I'm not up to date on contemporary theology, I have to admit. I have a prejudice against it, perhaps. I consider it quite soft, you know, not intellectually rigorous. I like Karl Barth, I admire him. He's an amazing thinker and writer.
Who's that?
Karl Barth. He's a Reformed theologian and Swiss German, and who died in the middle of the 20th century. But my reading is a little antiquarian, partly because when they're good, they're great, and when they're bad, you can excuse them on the grounds that they were writing in the 17th century. But I read things that most people would consider, I think, rather off the point. You know, I'm very interested in the period of English literature before Shakespeare, and I read that sort of thing. It's rigorous, difficult, stimulating. But my theological thinking is pretty firmly rooted in the classics.
Thank you. As a person of faith, one of the things that I find most puzzling is that people think of religion as a crutch, and I think Lila is a great character in showing how untrue that is, and I wonder what reaction you get from atheists who read your work.
You know, a lot of atheists are perfectly generous in the reading the book. They say, I didn't know people thought this way, it's interesting. You know. I think that we are too prone to put people in very hard categories. You know, who knows what anybody most deeply thinks. But the idea of religion as a crutch is a strange. That we hear all these things that, for some reason, affect the thinking of people who are in fact religious, and who perhaps find religion to be a huge demand. You know, I think virtually every deeply religious person does. I would like to do this, I would like to ignore this person, but I can't because, you know? And this becomes so acculturated that you don't think of it anymore, but it is religious behavior. You are governed, and the idea of violating what you think is appropriate religious behavior is very disturbing, you know? I think lots of religious people would be kind of relieved if they thought that they just died and went to oblivion. You know, the idea of actually having, in some sense, to make an account of your life is a very sobering thought, you know. I think that people accept as true characterizations that are made from the outside, you know. We have an imaginary friend. Oh, yes, read Jeremiah, you know. It's so trivial. I mean, every time I read one of these people, and these Dawkins and these people are just sort of little Muppet sort of things that he studied crickets before he turned to generalizing about science. But in any case, In any case, he became disillusioned with religion when he was 14, as I recall, and so have most of them at 14. And then ever afterward, they have a 14-year-old's understanding of what religion is. And the fact that churches try to deal with this great problem and so on, when they should just sort of overstep it. It's not about anything, you know?
Hello. Reading your past two books, I keep getting an idea of a conflict between thievery and inheritance. And I'm just, like, whether it be a car and home or a child and attempted in Lila, I'm just curious what the precedent is. This seems like a theme in the past two books, and I'm curious whether it's a religious or a non-sectarian question that you seem to be debating between characters and...
Right. Could you state the opposition again? I didn't quite hear you.
They were thievery and inheritance.
Thievery and inheritance. I suppose what you're talking about is a sense that I have that there's an arbitrariness in anything that happens to us or anything that we claim. You know, somebody can say the word father, but if he has abandoned his child to a disreputable flop house, then in what sense is he a father? You know, if someone picks up a child and gives it the means to live and gives it love and so on, in what sense is she not the mother? You know, I mean, it seems to me as if what we have, we can't really account for what befalls us, and the qualitative content of a relationship has as much or more to do with it, you know, than the sort of received ideas of what is inherited or what is owned.
Thank you very much. You were speaking earlier about being trapped. What was it? Trapped in small inhuman models of thinking that are inappropriate to us. Could you expand on that a little bit more? And then is that a theme that's in Lila?
I kind of hope it's a theme in my books, typically, you know. I'm struck by this new enthusiasm that is called neuroscience, you know, which once, I mean, who knows what could be done under that rubric, but in fact, the way it tends to be articulated is emotion is merely the firing of neurons, you know. You think you're doing thus and so, but in fact, it's really a lobe somewhere that's doing it, and so on. What in the world can this possibly mean, you know, in the utter complexity and the utter variety of human motive and thought? You know, it says, you know, every brain, I always tell my students this, but I love it. The human brain is the most complex object known to exist in the universe. Everybody has one. Isn't that splendid? But the thing is that anything that exists at that level of complexity as a physical object and then is complicated by experience, by all the accidents of life, what in the world does it mean to say the brain does this, the brain is that? You know, if you refuse to grant all the nuancing influences of heritage and experience and so on, you're not talking about human beings, you know? And that's one of what is the reductionist impulse? Why can't we say this person is different from that person? And there's a huge richness in the fact of difference, in the fact that through this medium of the brain, in all the varieties that it is shared, gives us a fantastically rich, interesting human world, you know?
I'm a huge fan of your books, and as a Jew, I think that you made me understand for the first time about the real underpinnings of Christianity that's certainly not expressed in this culture in a in a large way these days. But my question to you is about your writing. I was just amazed in Lila how you could get into this person's head and spend all of this time in her head and going through this, you know, talk about the brain, all this complexity of thinking in her head. And I'm just interested in your process of a writer, how you do that. How do you sit with this character and then bring it out into words?
Can I amplify the question, if you don't mind? It's not just all the time in the head, but that then you've been in Lila's head and she'll say four words. You know everything she's been thinking, but you also know that she will only say four or five words, and that stuns me.
Well, you know, I mean, I always have to kind of weasel out of questions like this because my novels always begin with my feeling that I know a voice. I can't write fiction unless there's a voice. I suppose the same thing might be true of nonfiction. But I don't know how my mind parses it out. But at a certain point, I know how this person would think and speak. And then when it's clear in my mind, whatever that means, usually that I have the first page, then I can somehow or other test my options against this essential knowledge of what would be said, would be thought, you know, what the intonation of the voice would be. And that's what guides me through the fiction. And frankly, my books typically end before I wish they would. I usually sit down to write my first 600-page novel, you know, and then at about, you know, at 300, if things go well for me, the novel closes, and I have nothing to say in the matter. I can feel the descent. I can feel the closure.
Up here, Marilyn. Thanks so much for coming to LA. I would have to say Housekeeping is my favorite novel, which is fun to tell somebody that wrote it. And I just find it to be a deeply feminist novel, and I just wonder if you could speak to your thoughts on that.
Well, it's feminist in a slightly roundabout way, perhaps. My brother teases me because I told him it would be called Moby Jane. I have always loved Moby Dick, and people told me at a certain point if I was a feminist I couldn't love Moby Dick because there are no women in it, basically. And so I truly thought to myself, if I could write a novel that had only women characters and men could read it without feeling excluded, or perhaps without even being aware that they were reading a novel in which their image was not mirrored, if I could write a novel with only women in it that men could experience as a satisfying novel, then I got Moby Dick. You know? Feminism, I think the best thing, you know, feminism has been an enormous boon to women in my generation and subsequently, I hope. And I think that past every other consideration, the best thing for women to do is to do what they want to do as well as they can do it. And if that means, you know, creating a novel art, then do that, you know. But I mean, I think that feminism is too, perhaps, willing to brood over the fact that for 25 million years, however many years, you know, they have been disparaged or excluded or whatever. Well, then let's not do that anymore. You know, we have the option of doing entirely otherwise. And so, I mean, it's a feminist book in the sense that I think you can write a completely full world that has only female characters. And I think you can write a completely full world that has only male characters. There's absolute equality in that.
Marilynne Robinson, I want to thank you for doing what you do so well. Thank you, Michael. Thank you all so much. I think we're going to...
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.